The Holy Gospel according to St. Matthew, the 22nd chapter. Then the Pharisees went and plotted to entrap Jesus in what he said. So they sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians, saying, "Teacher, we know that you are sincere and teach the way of God in accordance with truth, and show no deference to anyone, for you do not regard people with partiality. Tell us then what you think. Is it lawful to pay taxes to the emperor or not?" But Jesus, aware of their malice, said, "Why are you putting me to the test, you hypocrites? Show me the coin used for the tax." And they brought him a denarius. Then he said to them, "Whose head is this, and whose title?" They answered, "The emperor's." Then Jesus said to them, "Give therefore to the emperor the things that are the emperor's, and to God the things that are God's." When they heard this, they were amazed, and they left him and went away. The Gospel of the Lord. "It has rarely been clearer," writes Alan Trachtenberg, "that the business of business is now everyone's business. The business of business has become everyone's business." And in the ongoing conversation and in the ongoing protests, we have those who will look at corporations, lifting them up for what they have accomplished, what they can accomplish, and the importance of those corporations in our capitalistic economy. We will also find those, and among this group here today, who will hold fast the same claim that we see coming from the group gathered over on Prince Street, that corporations are evil, corporations are wrong. I don't think that either response is the solution to the conversation. It is not that simple. And there is required of us engagement and hard work to address what we are facing in the United States of America. Let's take a look at this story from the Gospel of Matthew. Let me give you a little background about this text. It's called a conflict text, and that's usually when someone comes up to Jesus and starts with flattery. And here's a word of warning to any of you. If someone comes up to you and starts telling you about how good you are, you should be ready for the trap to spring right afterwards. The goal is to trap Jesus with a question that on the surface seems innocent, but his answer will get him in trouble no matter which way he goes with his response. Jesus is masterful in these conflict texts of recognizing what is going on, speaking to the real issue, and sending people away stunned and amazed. The same thing all of you do after you leave the sermon every Sunday morning here at Trinity, as opposed to being dumbfounded and confused, I guess. Prevalent in Jesus' time and the context for this story is the issue of taxes. The people in Galilee were living under an extreme burden of taxation. And it was coming from a number of different sources. There are actually four, so it's not 999, but it's more like 4444, I think. First of all, the people had to pay tribute to the Roman government, which was occupying their native land, and that was an expensive endeavor. The building programs of Herod the great King Herod, were expanding, and they needed money to complete those building programs. Yes, the good religious people were part of the equation as well, and there was a temple tax in order to maintain and work on the upkeep of the temple. And there were tolls. Any time that you would travel any main transportation route, you would have to pay a toll to travel that route. People were living under the burden of heavy taxation. What we find out is the peasants of that time, many of them had lost their land, had lost their property, had to become sharecroppers on their own property in order to eke out some kind of existence. And at that moment, David Buttrick writes in his own reflections, it's possible that 7% of the people controlled 90% of the wealth of that area. The wealthy people were the religious people. The trap that Jesus was being drawn into was reflective of how he would answer the question, should we pay taxes to Rome? If he says, yes, we should pay taxes to Rome, then the peasants who had been gathering around him, following him and supporting him, would immediately turn against him, and he wouldn't have that strong following. But if he said, no, you should not pay the taxes to Rome, then the Romans would swoop in and arrest him. Either way, Jesus would no longer be a problem for the religious leaders of that day. So they come up to Jesus and they say, is it lawful for us to pay taxes to Rome? Jesus is masterful in his response. Instead of answering immediately, Jesus asked to see one of the coins that they were carrying. That's a masterful response because the Roman government had minted a silver coin that had the image of the Roman emperor on it, as well as the inscription to the effect that the Roman emperor was lord of all. That was considered to be a sacrilege in the lives of the good Jewish people of the time. And so they had minted their own coin made out of bronze that did not have that image on it. Jesus asked for the coin. Notice which coin the good religious leaders of the time provided to him. The Roman coin. They were carrying in their own wallets the coin they claimed was sacrilegious. And by producing that coin out of their own wallets, they answered their own question. So here is the RTM translation of this text. That's the Reverend Tim Mentzer translation of this text. He says, show me the coin used for the tax. And they all looked around at each other because they knew what was going to happen next. They'd have to pull out this Roman coin. And finally, someone sheepishly handed Jesus the coin. He said, whose image is this? He asked that question because it's not that he didn't recognize who it was, but because he wanted the crowd to know what kind of coin these religious leaders were carrying. It's the Roman coin, and you can hear the gasps of those who are gathered around. And Jesus looks at them, and he says to them, you know what you should do. And then he takes the coin, and he flips it with his thumb, and no one wants to catch it for fear they'll be the one accused of carrying the coin. You know what you should do. As they are walking away, Jesus adds this phrase, but give to God everything that belongs to God. You know what you should do, and what you should do comes from acknowledging that God is Lord of all. For Jesus, that question, what should you do, is a powerful question by nature of where this story falls in the Gospel of Matthew. It falls as he is preparing to meet his own death on that Friday, his death by the cross. He knew what he needed to do, to go to his death out of obedience to God, who is Lord of all. But it is also a text that is written to a congregation that is facing amazing odds and opposition, both from the Jewish community and from the Roman community, people being arrested and losing their own lives because of their faith. You know what you should do if you contend that God is Lord of all. So what about today? How do we phrase it today? The spiritual dilemma that I think that we are facing today is not reflective of the issue of death, which was primary for the people of Jesus' time, or as Stanley Hauerwas writes, the issue of guilt, which was prevalent in the time of the Reformation. Is it good works that help you overcome your guilt in God's eyes, or is it God's grace? In our day and age, the dilemma we face is this. We don't want to do the hard work that is required of us to get what we need. We don't want to do the hard work that is required of us to get what we need. The assumption you have is this, that just because you exist, you are lovable and entitled to whatever you want. Ain't necessarily so. It is a call to faithfulness. A faithfulness that first comes to each one of you because God is faithful to you. God does not abandon. God does not reject. But God is saving each one of you. Because that turns each of our lives upside down, it requires extraordinary work on our part to determine what is right and what is wrong. In this day and age, then, when we are confronted with a lot of talk about the business of business, we are, I think, required to do the hard work of determining what is good and what is wrong. And that determination isn't as simple as saying corporations are evil or corporations are beneficial. Back in 1819, Chief Justice John Marshall, in a decision, said that corporations are artificial beings existing only in contemplation of the law. They are legal entities. Just after the Civil War, a member of the Massachusetts Railroad Commission, in speaking about corporations, have said, "We now have a new power for which our language contains no name." In the 1880s, Jackson Lear writes that a corporation has become a legal person with all of the rights and none of the responsibilities. Corporations are created by legal act. They are identified by a number, both by the federal government and the state government, identified with an address and a location and a board of government. But what corporations do on top of that legal existence is they create an image for who they are, dependent upon what product they desire to sell. They create an image and present that image to us so that we can determine whether we will respond to their invitation to buy their products. I don't think it's an issue of whether corporations are moral or immoral. When we look at corporations, we can become aware that there are some corporations who have stepped up to the plate and have done good work in the face of governments that fail to do the necessary work required of the government. We saw that after the tsunami hit Sri Lanka, the Swedish government wasn't prepared to evacuate all of their nationals, but a Swedish tourist agent stepped up to the plate and evacuated over 4,500 people through his company. But at the same time, we are aware of Alan Greenspan's admission. He has admitted what his flaw in his own thinking has been. He realizes he was flawed in assuming that the self-interest of the manager is consistent with the interest of the stakeholders. That there will be managers who, to meet their own self-interests, exploit their companies and exploit other people. These corporations put in front of us proposals for images of who we can be. It's part of what marketing is about. They put in front of me the image of the Marlboro man, this great rugged individual with the cowboy hat and the mountains behind them and the rugged terrain in the back. The only way I don't fit into that image is I would be sleeping in a Holiday Inn that night and not at a tent next to a campfire. Probably wouldn't be riding a horse either. I'd be riding one of those John Deere gators instead. But it put in front of us an image of what we should look like, what we should sound like, and how we should act. We all have in our own selves an image of what we think we look like. We have an image of what we think we sound like. We have an image of what we think people look at us and how they see us. That's one of the reasons that I like going into other people's houses that are shorter than me, because their mirrors are lower. Because I live with the delusion that I have wavy, curly hair. And if I come into most of your houses, your mirrors are lower, and so I can only see up to here on my head, and my imagination can fill in the rest of the gaps. I don't like to have someone hold in front of me what I don't think that I am. I don't listen to the recordings of my own sermons. I know that as soon as you leave this place, you download those and listen to them repeatedly over the week, because I don't want to listen to the sound of my voice every week, because I think it sounds one way. If I listen to myself, it doesn't sound the way that I expect. And I have a perception that every one of you hangs on every word that I use this morning and every day, and will be repeating that to everyone that you talk to this week. I don't want you to tell me otherwise. We have put in front of us images of what we can be. Corporations offer us the products that help us accomplish that. and in a time when we want to continue to re-image ourselves because we don't like the way that we look. We don't like the way that we sound. We don't like the way people think about us. We are open to acquiring those products. I have to the side of my house a large holly bush that through the last couple of months, this vine has grown all the way through the holly bush. And it is very difficult to separate the vine from the bush. They have become so intertwined with each other. In our conversation about business, what is right and wrong is so intertwined with each other, it's not as simple as saying corporations are right or that they are wrong. But it requires extraordinarily hard work on our parts to unpack what is happening in our nation right now. I want to leave you with this word. The word is theologize. And it's an important word because to theologize equips you for your Christian witness this week as you go out and spread the gospel of Christ to other people. Theologizing is what I do with the children's sermon each week, to open that box, to take a look at that item, and to be able to reflect upon that item and about human life in a way that speaks about God and speaks about our faith lives. It is the ability to recognize that God is Lord of all and to talk about each and every object and existence in our country in a way that reflects that God is Lord of all and engaging in the hard work of determining when that is faithful to the kingdom of God and when it runs counter to what God is calling us to do. Amen.